This is Audible.
HarperCollins presents Night of Error by Desmond Bagley, read by Paul Tyerman. And when with grief you see your brother stray, or in a night of error lose his way, direct his wandering and restore the day. So guide his steps, afford your kindest aid, and gently pity whom you can't persuade. Leave to avenging heaven his stubborn will, for oh, remember, he's your brother still. Jonathan Swift. Preface. The Pacific Islands Pilots, Volume 2, published by the Hydrographer of the Navy, has this to say about the island of Funafuti, almost at the end of a long and detailed history. In 1963, HMNZ FA Tui reported a hard grey rock with a depth of 6 feet over it, on which the sea breaks, and general depths of 36 feet extending for 2 miles northwards and 1.5 miles westward of the rock, in the position of the bank. The eastern side is steep too. In the vicinity of the rock, there was much discoloured water caused by sulphurous gas bubbles rising to the surface. On the bank, the bottom was clearly visible and consisted of fine black cellar lava, like volcanic cinder, with patches of white sand and rock. Numerous sperm whales were seen in the vicinity. But that edition was not published until 1969. This story began in 1962. 1. I heard of the way my brother died, on a wet and gloomy afternoon in London. The sky was overcast and weeping, and it became dark early that day, much earlier than usual. I couldn't see the figures I was checking, so I turned on the desk light and got up to close the curtains. I stood for a moment, watching the rain leak from the plane trees on the embankment, then looked over the mist-shrouded Thames. I shivered slightly, wishing I could get out of this grey city and back to sea under tropic skies. I drew the curtain decisively, closing out the gloom. The telephone rang. It was Helen, my brother's widow, and she sounded hysterical.
"Mike, there's a man here, Mr. Kane, who was with Mark when he died. I think you'd better see him."
Her voice broke.
"I can't take it, Mike."
"All right, Helen, shoot him over. I'll be here until 5:30. Can you make it before then?" There was a pause and an indistinct murmur. Then Helen said,
"Yes, he'll be at the Institute before then. Thanks, Mike." "Oh, and there's a slip from British Airways. Something has come from Tahiti. I think it must be Mark's things. I posted it to you this morning. Will you look after it for me? I don't think I could bear to."
"I'll do that," I said. "I'll look after everything." She rang off, and I put down the receiver slowly and leaned back in my chair. Helen seemed distraught about Mark, and I wondered what this man Kane had told her. All I knew was that Mark had died somewhere in the islands near Tahiti. The British consul there had wrapped it all up, and the Foreign Office had got in touch with Helen as next of kin. She never said so, but it must have been a relief. Her marriage had caused her nothing but misery. She should never have married him in the first place. I had tried to warn her, but it's a bit difficult telling one's prospective sister-in-law about the iniquities of one's own brother, and I'd never got it across. Still, she must have loved him despite everything, judging by the way she was behaving. But then Mark had a way with his women. One thing was certain, Mark's death wouldn't affect me a scrap. I had long ago taken his measure and had steered clear of him and all his doings, all the devious and calculating cold-blooded plans which had only one end in view, the glorification of Mark Trevelyan. I put him out of my mind, adjusted the desk lamp, and got down to my figures again. People think of scientists, especially oceanographers, as being constantly in the field, making esoteric discoveries. They never think of the office work entailed, and if I didn't get clear of this routine work, I'd never get back to sea. I thought that if I really buckled down to it, another day would see it through, and then I would have a month's leave, if I could consider writing a paper for the journals as constituting leave. But even that would not take up the whole month. At 6:15, I packed it in for the day, and Kane had still not shown up. I was just putting on my overcoat when there was a knock on the door, and when I opened it, a man said, "Mr. Trevelyan." Kane was a tall, haggard man of about 40, dressed in rough seaman's clothing and wearing a battered peaked cap. He seemed subdued and a little in awe of his surroundings. As we shook hands, I could feel the calluses and thought that perhaps he was a sailing man. Steam seamen don't have much occasion to do that kind of handwork. I said, "I'm sorry to have dragged you across London on a day like this, Mr. Kane." "That's all right," he said, in a raw Australian accent. "I was coming up this way." I sized him up. "I was just going out. What about a drink?" He smiled. "That'd be fine. I like your English beer." We went to a nearby pub, and I took him into the public bar and ordered a couple of beers. He sank half a pint and gasped luxuriously. "This is good beer," he said. "Not as good as Swan, but good all the same. You know Swan beer?" "I've heard of it," I said. "I've never had any." "Australian, isn't it?" "Yeah. The best beer in the world." To an Australian, all things Australian are the best. "Would I be correct if I said you'd done your time in sale?" I said. He laughed. "Too right you would. How do you know?" "I've sailed myself. I suppose it shows somehow." "Then I won't have to explain too much detail when I tell you about your brother. I suppose you want to know the whole story? I didn't tell Mrs. Trevelyan all of it, you know. Some of it's pretty grim. I'd better know everything." Kane finished his beer and cocked an eye at me. "Another? Not for me just yet. You go ahead." He ordered another beer and said, "Well, we were sailing in the Society Islands, my partner and me. We've got a schooner, and we do a bit of trading and pick up copper and maybe a few pearls. We were in the Tuamutus. The locals call them the Powamutus, but they're the Tuamutus on the charts. They're east of..." "I know where they are," I interrupted. "Okay, well, we thought there was a chance of picking up a few pearls, so we were just cruising around calling on the inhabited islands. Most of them aren't, and most of them don't have names, not names that we can pronounce. Anyway, we were passing this one when a canoe came out and hailed us. There was a boy in this canoe, a Polynesian, you know, and Jim talked to him. Jim Hadley is my partner. He speaks the lingo. I don't savvy it too good myself. What he said was that there was a white man on the island who was very sick, and so we went ashore to have a look at him. That was my brother." "Too right. And he was sick." "My word, yes." "What was wrong with him?" Kane shrugged. "We didn't know at first, but it turned out to be appendicitis. That's what we found out after we got a doctor to him."
"Then there was a doctor?"
"If you could call him a doctor. He was a drunken old no-hoper who'd been living in the islands for years. But he said he was a doctor. He wasn't there, though. Jim had to go 50 miles to get him, while I stayed with your brother." Kane took another pull at his beer. "Your brother was alone on this island, except for the black boy. There wasn't no boat, either. He said he was some sort of scientist, something to do with the sea."
"An oceanographer. Yes, like me, an oceanographer."
Mark had always felt compelled, driven, to try and beat me, whatever the game, and his rules were always his own.
"Too right. He said he'd been dropped there to do some research, and he was due to be picked up any time."
"Why didn't you take him to the doctor instead of bringing the doctor to him?" I asked.
"We didn't think he'd make it," said Kane simply. A little ship like ours bounces about a lot, and he was pretty sick.
I see, I said. He was painting a rough picture.
I did what I could for him, said Kane. There wasn't much I could do, though, beyond cleaning him up. We talked a lot about this and that. That was when he asked me to tell his wife.
Well, surely he didn't expect you to make a special trip to England, I demanded, thinking that even in death it sounded like Mark's touch.
Oh, it was nothing like that, said Kane. You see, I was coming to England anyway. I won a bit of money in a sweep, and I always wanted to see the old country. Jim, my cobber, said he could carry on alone for a bit, and he dropped me at Panama. I bummed a job on a ship coming to England.
He smiled ruefully.
I won't be staying here as long as I thought. I dropped a packet in a poker game coming across. I'll stay until my cash runs out, and then I'll go back to Jim and the schooner.
I said, what happened when the doctor came?
Oh, sure. You want to know about your brother? Sorry if I got off track. Well, Jim brought this old no-good back, and he operated. He said he had to. It was your brother's only chance. Pretty rough it was, too. The doc's instruments weren't any too good. I helped him. Jim hadn't the stomach for it.
He fell silent, looking back into the past.
I ordered another couple of beers, but Kane said, I'd like something stronger if you don't mind. So I changed the order to whiskey.
I thought of some drunken oaf of a doctor cutting my brother open with blunt knives on a benighted tropical island. It wasn't a pretty thought, and I think Kane saw the horror of it too, the way he gulped his whiskey. It was worse for him. He had been there.
So he died, I said.
Well, not right away. He seemed okay after the operation. Then he got worse. The doc said it was peritonitis? That's it. I remember it sounded like peri-peri sauce, like having something hot in your guts. He got a fever and went delirious. Then he went unconscious and died 2 days after the operation.
He looked into his glass.
We buried him at sea. It was stinking hot, and we couldn't carry the body anywhere. We hadn't any ice. We sewed him up in canvas and put him over the side. The doctor said he'd see to all the details. I mean, it wasn't any use for Jim and me to go all the way to Papeete. The doc knew all we knew.
You told the doctor about Mark's wife, her address and so on? Kane nodded.
Mrs. Trevelyan said she'd only just heard about it. That's the island's postal service for you. You know, he never gave us nothing for her. No personal stuff, I mean. We wondered about that. But she said some gear of his is on the way. That right?
It might be that, I said.
There's something at Heathrow now. I'll probably pick it up tomorrow.
When did Mark die, by the way?
He reflected.
Must have been about 4 months ago. You don't go much for dates and calendars when you're cruising the islands, not unless you're navigating and looking up the almanac all the time. And Jim's the expert on that. I reckon it was about the beginning of May.
Jim dropped me at Panama in July and I had to wait a bit to get a ship across here.
Do you remember the doctor's name or where he came from?
Kane frowned.
I know he was a Dutchman. His name was Scoot something. Well, as near as I can remember, it might have been Scooter. He runs a hospital on one of the islands. My word, I can't remember that either.
It's of no consequence. If it becomes important, I can get it from the death certificate.
I finished my whiskey.
The last I heard of Mark, he was working with a Swede called Norgard. You didn't come across him.
Kane shook his head.
There was only your brother. We didn't stay around, you know. Not when old Scooter said he'd take care of everything.
You think this Norgard was supposed to pick your brother up when he'd finished his job?
Something like that, I said.
It's been very good of you to take the trouble to tell us about Mark's death.
He waved my thanks aside.
No trouble at all. Anyone would have done the same. I didn't tell Mrs. Trevelyan too much, you understand? I'll edit it when I tell her, I said. Anyway, thanks for looking after him. I wouldn't like to think he died alone. Ah, look, said Kane, embarrassed. We couldn't do anything else now, could we?
I gave him my card. I'd like you to keep in touch, I said.
Perhaps when you are ready to go back, I can help you with a passage. I have plenty of contacts with the shipping people.
Oh, too right, he said.
I'll keep in touch, Mr. Trevelyan.
I said goodbye and left the bar, ducking into the private bar in the same pub. I didn't think Kane would go in there, and I wanted a few quiet thoughts over another drink. I thought of Mark dying a rather gruesome death on that lonely Pacific atoll. God knows that Mark and I didn't see eye to eye, but I wouldn't have wished that fate on my worst enemy. And yet, there was something odd about the whole story. I wasn't surprised at him being in the Tuamotus. It was his job to go poking about odd corners of the Seven Seas, as it was mine. But something struck a sour note. For instance, what had happened to Norgard? It certainly wasn't standard operating procedure for a man to be left entirely alone on a job. I wondered what Mark and Norgard had been doing in the Tuamotus. They had published no papers, so perhaps their investigation hadn't been completed. I made a mental note to ask old Jarvis about it. My boss kept his ear close to the grapevine and knew everything that went on in the profession. But it wasn't that which worried me. It was something else, something niggling at the back of my mind that I couldn't resolve. I chased it around for a bit, but nothing happened. So I finished my drink and went home to my flat for a late-night session with some figures. 2. The next day, I was at the office bright and early and managed to get my work finished just before lunch. I was attacking my neglected correspondence when one of the girls brought in a visitor, and a most welcome one. Geordie Wilkins had been my father's sergeant in the commandos during the war, and after my father had been killed, he took an interest in the sons of the man he had so greatly respected. Mark, typically, had been a little contemptuous of him, but I liked Geordie, and we got on well together. He had done well for himself after the war. He foresaw the yachting boom and bought himself a 25-ton cutter, which he chartered and in which he gave sailing lessons. Later, he gave up tuition and had worked up to a 200-ton brigantine, which he chartered to rich Americans mostly, taking them anywhere they wanted to go at an exorbitant price. Whenever he put into England, he looked me up, but it had been a while since I'd last seen him. He came into the office, bringing with him a breath of sea air. "My God, Mike, but you're pallid," he said. "I'll have to take you back to sea. Geordie, where have you sprung from this time?" "The Caribbean," he said. "I brought the old girl over for a refit. I'm in between charters, thank God. Where are you staying?" "With you, if you'll have me. Esmeralda's here." "Oh, don't be an idiot," I said happily. "You know you're welcome. We seem to have struck it lucky this time. I have to do a bit of writing, which will take a week, and then I've got 3 weeks spare." He rubbed his chin. "I'm tied up for a week too, but I'm free after that. We'll push off somewhere." "That's a great idea," I said. "I've been dying to get away. Wait while I check this post, would you?" The letter I had just opened was from Helen. It contained a brief letter and the advisory note from British Airways. There was something to be collected from Heathrow, which had to clear customs. I looked up at Geordie. "Did you know that Mark is dead?" He looked startled. "Dead? When did that happen?" I told him all about it, and he said, "A damned sticky end, even for Mark." Then he immediately apologised. "Sorry, I shouldn't have said that." "Ah, quit it, Geordie," I said irritably. "You know how I felt about Mark. There's no need to be mealy-mouthed with me.
Aye, he was a bit of a bastard, wasn't he? How's that wife of his taking it? About average under the circumstances. She was pretty broken up, but I seem to detect an underlying note of relief. She's best to remarry and forget him, said Geordie, bluntly. He shook his head slowly. It beats me what the woman saw in Mark. He treated them like dirt, and they sat up and begged for more. Some people have it, some don't, I said. If it means being like Mark, I'd rather not have it. Sad to think one can't find a good word to say for the man. He took the paper out of my hand. Got a car I can use. I haven't been in one for months, and I'd like the drive. I'll get my gear from Esmeralda and go out and pick this stuff up for you. I tossed him my car keys. Thanks. It's the same old wreck. You'll find it in the car park. When he had gone, I finished up my paperwork and then went to see the prof to pay my respects. Old Jarvis was quite cordial. You've done a good job, Mike, he said. I've looked at your stuff briefly, and if your correlations are correct, I think we're on to something. Thank you. He leaned back in his chair and started to fill his pipe. You'll be writing a paper, of course. I'll do that while I'm on leave, I said. It won't be a long one, just a preliminary. There's still a lot of sea time to put in. Looking forward to getting back to it, are you? I'll be glad to get away. He grunted suddenly. For every day you spend at sea, you'll have 3 in the office digesting the data. And don't get into a job like mine. It's all office work. Steer clear of administration, my boy. Don't get chair-bound. I won't, I promised, and then changed tack. Can you tell me anything about a fellow called Norgard? I think he's a Swede working on ocean currents. Jarvis looked at me from under bushy eyebrows. Wasn't he the chap working with your brother when he died? That's the man. He pondered, then shook his head. I haven't heard anything of him lately. He certainly hasn't published. But I'll make a few inquiries and put you in touch. And that was that. I didn't know why I had taken the trouble to ask the prof about Norgard, unless it was still that uneasy itch at the back of my skull, the feeling that something was wrong somewhere. It probably didn't mean anything anyway, and I put it out of my mind as I walked back to my office. It was getting late, and I was about ready to leave when Geordie returned and heaved a battered, ancient suitcase onto my desk. There it is, he said. They made me open it. It was a wee bit difficult without the key, though. What did you do? Busted the lock, he said cheerfully. I looked at the case warily. What's in it? Not much. Some clothes, a few books, and a lot of pebbles. And there's a letter addressed to Mark's wife. He untied the string, holding the case together, skimmed the letter across the desk, and started to haul out the contents. A couple of tropical suits, not very clean, 2 shirts, 3 pairs of socks, 3 textbooks on oceanography, very up-to-date, a couple of notebooks in Mark's handwriting, and a miscellany of pens, toiletries, and small odds and ends. I looked at the letter addressed to Helen in a neat, cursive hand. I'd better open this, I said. We don't know what's in it, and I don't want Helen to get too much of a shock. Geordie nodded, and I slit the envelope. The letter was short and rather abrupt. Dear Mrs. Trevelyan, I am sorry to tell you that your husband, Mark, is dead, although you may know this already by the time you get this. Mark was a good friend to me and left some of his things in my care. I am sending them all to you as I know you would like to have them. Sincerely, P. Nelson. I said, I thought this would be official, but it's not. Geordie scanned the short note. Do you know this chap, Nelson? Never heard of him. Geordie put the letter on the desk and tipped up the suitcase. Then there are these. A dozen or so potato-like objects rolled onto the desk. Some of them rolled further and thumped onto the carpet, and Geordie stooped and picked them up. You'll probably make more sense of these than I can.
I turned one in my fingers. "Manganese nodules," I said. "Very common in the Pacific."
"Are they valuable?"
I laughed. "If you could get at them easily, they might be. But you can't, so they aren't. They lie on the seabed at an average depth of about 14,000 feet. He looked closely at one of the nodules. "I wonder where he got these, then. It's a bit deep for skin diving. They're probably souvenirs of the IGY, the International Geophysical Year." Mark was a physical chemist on one of the ships in the Pacific. I took one of the notebooks and flipped the pages at random. Most of it seemed to be mathematical, the equations close-packed in Mark's finicky hand. I tossed it into the open suitcase. "Let's get this stuff packed away, then we'll go home." So we put everything back, higgledy-piggledy, and carted the case down to the car. On the way home, Geordie said, "What about a show tonight?" On his rare visits to a city, he had a soft spot for big, gaudy musicals. "Well, if you can get tickets," I said. "I don't feel like queuing." "I'll get them," he said, confidently. "I know someone who owes me a few favours. Look, drop me right here, and I'll see you at the flat in half an hour, but maybe a bit longer." I dropped him, and when I got to where I lived, I took Mark's suitcase first, because it came handiest. Then I went back to the car for Geordie's gear. For some time I pottered about estimating what I'd need for a trip away with him, but I'd most of what I needed, and the list of things I had to get was very short, and didn't take that long to figure out. After a while, I found myself looking at the suitcase. I picked it up, put it on the bed, and opened it, and looked at the few remnants of Mark's life. I hoped that when I went, I'd leave more than a few books, a few clothes, and a doubtful reputation. The clothing was of no particular interest, but as I lifted up a jacket, a small leather-bound notebook fell out of the breast pocket. I picked it up and examined it. It had obviously been used as a diary, but most of the entries were in shorthand, once Pitman's, but adapted in an idiosyncratic way, so that they were incomprehensible to anyone but the writer, Mark. Occasionally, there were lines of chemical and mathematical notation, and every now and then there was a doodle drawing. I remembered that Mark had been a doodler even at school, and had been ticked off often because of the state of his exercise books. There wasn't much sense to be made of any of it. I put the diary on my dressing table and turned to the larger notebooks. They were much more interesting, although scarcely more comprehensible. Apparently, Mark was working on a theory of nodule formation that, to say the least of it, was harebrained, certainly from the point of view of orthodox physical chemistry. The timescale he was using was fantastic, and even at a casual glance, his qualitative analysis seemed out of line. Presently, I heard Geordie come in. He popped his head round the door of the bedroom and said triumphantly, "I've got the tickets. Let's have a slap-up dinner first and then go on to the theatre." "That's a damn good idea," I said. I threw the notebooks and the clothing back into the case and retied the lid down. Geordie nodded at it. "Find anything interesting?" I grinned. "Nothing, except that Mark was going round the bend. He'd got hold of some damn fool idea about nodules and was going overboard about it." I shoved the case under the bed and began to get dressed for dinner. 3. It was a good dinner and a better show, and we drove home replete with fine food and excellent entertainment. Geordie was in high spirits and sang in a cracked and tuneless voice one of the numbers from the show. We were both in a cheerful mood. I parked the car outside the block of flats and got out. There was still a thin drizzle of rain, but I thought that by morning it would have cleared. Well, that was good. I wanted fine weather for my leave. As I looked up at the sky, I stiffened. "Geordie, there's someone in my flat." He looked up at the third floor and saw what I had seen, a furtive hunting light moving at one of the windows. "That's a torch." His teeth flashed as he grinned in the darkness. "It's a long time since I've had a proper scrap," I said, "come on," and ran up into the foyer. Geordie caught my arm as I pressed for the lift. "Hold on, let's do this properly," he said. "Wait 1 minute and then go up in the lift. I'll take the stairs. We should arrive on your floor at the same time. Covers both exits." I grinned and saluted. "Yes, Sergeant. You can't keep an old soldier down." Geordie was making a military operation out of catching a sneak thief, but I followed orders. I went up in the lift and stepped out into the lighted corridor. Geordie had made good time up the stairs and was breathing as easily as though he'd been strolling on the level. He motioned me to keep the lift door open and reached inside to press the button for the top floor. I closed the door and the lift went up. He grinned in his turn. "Anyone leaving in a hurry must use the stairs now. Got your key?" I passed it to him, and we walked to the door of my flat, treading softly. Through the uncurtained kitchen window, I could see the flash of a torch. Geordie cautiously inserted the key into the lock. "We'll go in sharpish," he whispered, gave the key a twist, threw open the door, and plunged into the flat like an angry bull. As I followed on his heel, I heard a shout, "Oh!" And the next thing I knew was a blinding flash in my eyes, and I was grappling with someone at the kitchen door. Whoever it was hit me on the side of the head. It must have been with the torch because the light went out. I felt dizzy for a moment, but held on, thrusting forward and bringing my knee up sharply. I heard a gasp of pain, and above it, the roar of Geordie's voice from further in the flat, possibly the bedroom. I let go my grip and struck out with my fist and yelled in pain as my knuckles hit the kitchen door. My opponent squirmed out from where I had him pinned and was gone through the open door of the flat. Things were happening too fast for me. I could hear Geordie swearing at the top of his voice and the crash of furniture. A light tenor voice called,
"Oid, oid, no desperes, emplead cuchillos."
Then suddenly, someone else banged into me in the darkness, and I struck out again. I knew now that this assailant would certainly have a knife and possibly a gun, and I think I went berserk. It's wonderful what the adrenal glands will do for a man in an emergency. In the light from the corridor, I caught a glimpse of an upraised knife, and I chopped viciously at the wrist. There was a howl of pain, and the knife clattered to the floor. I aimed a punch at where I thought a stomach was, and missed. Something was swung at the side of my head again, and I went down as a black figure jumped over me. If he hadn't stopped to kick up my head, he would have got clean away. But I squirmed to avoid his boot and caught his leg, and he went sprawling into the corridor. I dived after him and got between him and the stairs, and he stood in a crouch, looking at me, his eyes darting about, looking for escape. Then I saw what he must have swung at my head in the flat. It was Mark's suitcase. Suddenly, he turned and ran towards the blank end of the corridor. "I've got him now," I thought exultantly, and went after him at a dead run. But he had remembered what I'd forgotten, the fire escape. He might have got away then, but once again I tackled him rugby fashion, so that I floored him just short of the fire escape. The fall knocked the breath out of me, and he improved the shining hour by kicking me in the face. Then, as I was shaking my head in dizziness, he tossed Mark's case into the darkness. By the time I regained my feet, I was between him and the metal staircase, and he was facing me with his right hand, now unencumbered, darting to his pocket. I saw the gun as he drew it, and knew the meaning of real fear. I jumped for him, and he sidestepped frantically, trying to clear the gun from his pocket, but the foresight must have caught on the lining. Then I hit him hard on the jaw, and he teetered on the top step of the fire escape. I hit him again, and slammed him against the railing, and to my horror, he jackknifed over. He didn't make a sound as he fell the three floors into the alley, and it seemed a long time before I heard the dull thump as he hit the ground. I looked down into the darkness and saw nothing. I was conscious of the trembling of my hands as they gripped the steel rail. There was a scurry of footsteps, and I turned to see Geordie darting down the stairs. "Leave them!" I shouted. "They're armed!" But he didn't stop, and all I heard was the thud of his feet as he raced down the staircase. The tall, thin man who lived in the next flat came out in a dressing gown. "Now, what's all this?" he asked querulously. "A chap can't listen to the radio with all this racket going on," I said. "Phone the police. There's been an attempted murder." His face went white, and he looked at my arm. I looked down and saw blood staining the edges of a slit in the sleeve of my jacket. I couldn't remember being knifed, and I felt nothing. I looked back up at him. "Well, hurry!" I yelled at him. A gunshot echoed up the stairwell, and we both started. "Christ!" I clattered down the stairs at top speed, all three flights, and came across Geordie in the foyer. He was sitting on the floor, staring at his fingers in amazement. They were red with welling blood. "The bastard shot me," he said, incredulously. "Where are you hit, for God's sake?" "In the hand, I think. I don't feel anything anywhere else, and he only fired one shot." I looked at his hand. Blood was spurting from the end of his little finger. I began to laugh, an hysterical sound not far from crying, and went on until Geordie slapped my face with his unwounded hand. "Pull yourself together, Mike," he said firmly. I became aware of doors slamming and voices upstairs, but as yet nobody had ventured down into the foyer itself, and I sobered suddenly. "I think I killed one of them," I said, emptily. "Don't be daft. How could you kill a man with your fist?" "I knocked him off the fire escape. He fell from the third floor." Geordie looked at me closely. "We'd better go and have a look at that. Are you all right?" We were both bleeding freely now. He was wrapping his finger in a handkerchief, which promptly turned bright red. "I'm okay. You can't call this a mortal wound," he said dryly. We went out into the street and walked quickly round to the alley into which the fire escape led. As we turned the corner, there was a sudden glare of light and the roar of an engine, together with a slamming of a car door. "Look out!" yelled Geordie, and flung himself sideways. I saw the two great eyes of headlamps rushing at me from the darkness of the alley, and I frantically flattened myself against the wall. The car roared past, and I felt the wind of it brush my trousers, and then, with a squeal of hard-used tyres, it turned the corner and was gone. I listened to the noise of the engine die away, and eased myself from the wall, taking a deep, shaky breath. In the light of the street lamp on the corner, I saw Geordie pick himself up. "Christ," I said. "You don't know what's going to happen next." "This lot aren't ordinary burglars," said Geordie, brushing himself down. "They're too bloody persistent." "Where's this fire escape?" "A bit further along," I said. We walked slowly up the alley, and Geordie fell over the man I had knocked over the edge. We bent down to examine him, and in the faint light we could see his head. It was twisted at an impossible angle, and there was a deep, bloody depression in the skull. Geordie said, "No need to look any further. He's dead." 4.
"And you say they were speaking Spanish?" said the inspector. I nodded wearily. "As soon as we went into the flat, someone shouted, 'Look out,' and then I was in the middle of a fight. A bit later on, another man shouted, 'Get out of here, don't shoot, use your knives.' I think it was the man I knocked off the fire escape." The inspector looked at me thoughtfully. "But you say he was going to shoot you?" "He'd lost his knife by then, and I was going for him." "How good is your Spanish, Mr. Trevelyan?" "Pretty good," I said. "I did a lot of work off Southwest Europe about 4 years ago, and I was based in Spain. I took the trouble to learn the language. I have a flair for them. The doctor tied a neat knot in the bandage round my arm and said, "That'll hold it, but try not to use the arm for a while." He packed his bag and went out. I sat up and looked about the flat. It was like a field dressing station in a blitzed area. I was stripped to the waist with a bandaged arm, and Geordie sported a natty bandage on his little finger. He was drinking tea, and he held out his finger like a charlady at a garden party. The flat was a wreck. What hadn't been broken by the burglars had been smashed during the fight. A chair with no legs lay in the corner, and broken glass from the front of my bookcase littered the carpet. A couple of uniformed constables stood stolidly in the corners, and a plain-clothed man was blowing powder about the place with an insufflator. The inspector said, "Once again, how many of them were there?" Geordie said, "I had two on my hands at one time." "I had a go at two," I said, "but I think that one of them had a bash at Geordie first. It's difficult to say, it happened so fast." "This man you heard, did he say knife or knives?" I thought about that. "He said knives." The inspector said, "Then there were more than two of them." Geordie said unexpectedly, "There were four." The inspector looked at him with raised eyebrows. "I saw three men in the car that passed us, one driving and two getting in a hurry. With one dead in the alley, that makes four." "Ah, yes," said the inspector. "They would have one man in the car. Tell me, how did you come to get shot?" A smile touched Geordie's lips. "How does anyone get shot with a gun?" The inspector recognised a touch of overexcitement and said dryly, "I mean, what were the circumstances?" "Well, I chased the little bastard down the stairs and damn nearly caught him in the foyer. He saw he was going to be copped, so he turned and let me have it. I hadn't reached him yet. I was so surprised I sat down, then I saw all the blood." "You say he was little?" "That he was. A little squirt of not more than 5'4". "So two men went down the stairs, there was one in the car, and one went over the fire escape," the inspector summarised. He had a blunt, square face with watchful grey eyes, which he suddenly turned on me like gimlets. "You say this man threw a suitcase into the alley?" "That's right. We haven't found it, Mr. Trevelyan." I said, "Well, the others must have picked it up. That's when they nearly ran us down." He said softly, "How did they know it was there?" "I don't know. They may have seen it coming over. I guess the car was parked in the alley, waiting for the others to come down that way." He nodded. "What was in the suitcase, do you know?" I glanced across at Geordie, who looked back at me expressionlessly. I said, "Some stuff belonging to my brother." "What kind of, stuff?" "Clothing, books, geological samples." The inspector sighed. "Anything important or valuable?" I shook my head. "I doubt it." "What about the samples?" I said, "I only saw the specimens briefly. They appeared to be manganese nodules of the type which is often to be found on the ocean bed. They're very common, you know." "And valuable?" he persisted. "I don't think that anyone with knowledge of them would regard them as valuable," I said. "I suppose they might be if they were generally accessible, but it's too hard to get at them through 2 or 3 miles of water." The inspector seemed at a loss. "How do you think your brother will regard the loss of those specimens and his other things?" "He's dead," I said. The inspector sharpened his attention. "Oh, when did he die?" "About 4 months ago, in the Pacific." He looked at me closely, and I went on. "My brother Mark was an oceanographer, like myself. He died of appendicitis a few months ago, and I've just received his effects today. As for the specimens, I would say they were souvenirs of the IGY survey in which he was engaged. As a scientist, he would naturally be interested in them." "Hmm,"
said the inspector. Is there anything else missing, Mr. Trevelyan? Not that I know of. Geordie clattered his cup. I think we were too quick for them, he said. They thought they were onto a good thing, but we didn't give them enough time. So one of them grabbed the first thing he saw and tried to make her get away. I carefully didn't mention that the case had been hidden under my bed. The inspector looked at Geordie with something approaching contempt. This isn't an ordinary burglary, he said. Your explanation doesn't account for the fact that they went to a lot of trouble to retrieve the suitcase, or why they used so many weapons. He turned to me. Have you any enemies in Spain? I shrugged. I shouldn't think so. He pursed his lips. All right, Mr. Trevelyan, let's go back to the beginning again. Let's start when you say you first saw the light on in your flat. It was after 3 a.m. before we got rid of the police, and they were back again next morning to recheck the premises and to hear the whole tale yet again. The inspector wasn't satisfied, but neither he nor any of his colleagues could pin down what was wrong. Come to that, neither could I. It was a great way to start my leave. His last word to me that morning was, "There's been a fatality here, Mr. Trevelyan, and that's a very serious matter. I shall expect both of you to hold yourselves in readiness for the inquest. You are not under arrest," he added in such a way as to make me feel that I was. He strode out of the flat with his myrmidons trailing behind. "In other words, don't leave town," I said. "There goes a very unhappy policeman." Geordie said, "He'll be burning up the wires looking for an expert on manganese nodules. He thinks there's something fishy there." Well, by God, so do I. But he won't find much. He'll phone the Institute, of course, and speak to Jarvis or some other big noise and get exactly the same story I told him. I got up, went into the kitchen, and got a couple of bottles of beer from the refrigerator and took them back into the living room. Geordie eyed them and said, "You have some good ideas sometimes. Tell me, these nodules, are they really valueless?" "I told the coppers the plain truth," I said. "But Mark seemed to have some curious ideas about nodule formation. Still, the notebooks are gone, and I can't check up on his theories without them." Then suddenly I remembered something. "Wait a minute," I said, and went into the bedroom. Sure enough, there it was, the little leather-bound diary still lying on my dressing table. The police would have had no reason to think it wasn't mine and hadn't touched it. I went back and tossed it to Geordie. "They didn't get that. I meant to tell you. I found it in a pocket of one of Mark's suits. What do you make of it?" He opened the book with interest, but I watched the enthusiasm seep out of him as he scanned the pages. "What the hell?" "That's Mark's patent Pitman variation," I said. "I doubt if old Isaac himself could make anything of it." "What are all the drawings?" "Mark was an inveterate doodler," I said. "You'd have to apply psychological theory to make anything of those." I sat mulling over the events of the previous day, trying to piece them together. "Geordie, listen to this," I said. "Mark dies, and Norgard, his colleague, disappears. Jarvis keeps his ear close to the ground and knows all the gossip of the profession, and if he says he hasn't heard anything of Norgard, then it's unlikely that anyone else has either." I held up a finger. "There's one thing." "Do you know anything about Norgard?" "Only that he's one of us oceanographers. He's a Swede, but he was on an American survey ship during the IGY. I lost sight of him after that. A lot of comradeship went for a bust when the operation closed down." "What's his speciality?" "Ocean currents.
He's one of those geniuses who can dredge up a bit of water and tell you which way it was flowing a million years ago last Wednesday. I don't think there's a name for his line yet, so I call it paleoequology. Well, there's a mouthful for you. Geordie raised his eyebrows.
Can they really do that kind of thing?
I grinned. They'd like you to believe so, and I've no reason to doubt it. But to my mind, there's a hell of a lot of theory balancing uneasily on too few facts. Well, my line is different. I analyse what I'm given, and if anyone wants to build any wacky theories on what I tell them, well, that's their affair. And Mark was like yourself, an analytical chemist. Why would he team up with Norgard? They don't seem to have anything in common, I said slowly. I don't know. I really don't know. I was thinking of the highly unlikely theory indicated in Mark's missing notebooks. All right, Geordie said. Norgard's disappeared, you think? What else have you got? Well, the next thing is Cain. The whole thing is too damn pat. Cain turns up, and we have a burglary. He knew the stuff was coming. I told him. Geordie chuckled. And how do you tie in the four Spanish burglars with Cain? Speaking as a non-theoreticist, that is. I'm damned if I know. There's something odd about that, too. I couldn't place the accent. It was one I've never heard before. You don't know them all, said Geordie. You'd have to be born Spanish to be that good. True. There was a long silence while I marshalled my thoughts. I wish I could get hold of Cain. You think there's something odd about him, don't you? I do, but I don't know what it is. I've been trying to bring it to the surface ever since I saw him. Mike, I think this is all a lot of nonsense, Geordie said decisively. I think your imagination is working overtime. You've had a shock about Mark's death, and another over the burglary. So have I come to that. But I don't think Norgard has mysteriously disappeared. I think he's probably sitting somewhere writing a thesis on prehistoric water. As for Cain, well, you've got nothing but a blind hunch. But I'll tell you what I'll do. If Cain is a seaman, he'll probably be down somewhere in Dockland, and if you want him that bad, I'll put my boys onto nosing around a bit. It's a pretty hopeless chance, but it's all I can do. Thanks, Geordie, I said. Meantime, I'd better ring Helen and tell her I've been burgled. She's not going to like hearing that Mark stuff is gone, but there's no hope for it. I can only play it down, tell her it was all worthless anyway. Are you going to pass on the notebook to her? I shook my head thoughtfully. What notebook? As far as she's concerned, it was all stolen. She could never make anything of that stuff of Mark's. But maybe I can. 5. I had nightmares that night. I dreamed of a lovely Pacific island with white beaches and waving palm fronds, where I wandered quite happily until I became aware that the sky was darkening and a cold, icy wind had arisen. I started to run, but my feet slipped in the soft sand, and I made no progress. And I knew what I was running from. He caught me at last with my back to a palm trunk, and came nearer and nearer, brandishing a rusty kitchen knife. I knew it was the Dutch doctor, although he was screaming in Spanish.
Empleat cuchillo! Cuchillo! Cuchillo!
He was drunk and sweaty-faced, and as he came nearer I felt powerless to move, and I knew he was going to stick me with a knife. At last his face was close to mine, and I could see the individual beads of sweat on his shiny forehead and his lean, dark face. It was the face of Cain. He drew back his arm and struck with a knife right into my guts. I woke with a yell. I was breathing deeply, taking in great gulps of air, and I could feel a slick film of sweat all over my body. The knife scratch in my arm was aching, and I knew at last what was wrong with Kane's story. The bedroom door opened, and Geordie said in a low voice, "What the devil's going on?" I said, "Come in, Geordie. I'm all right. It's just a nightmare." I switched on the bedside light, and Geordie said, "You gave me a hell of a fright, Mike." "I gave myself a hell of a fright," I said, and lit a cigarette. But I discovered something, or remembered something. "What?" I tapped Geordie emphatically on the chest with my forefinger. "Mark had his appendix out years ago." Geordie looked startled. "But the death certificate? I don't know anything about the death certificate. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know if it's a fake. But I know that Mr. Bloody Kane is a fake." "Are you sure about this?" "I still know the doctor who operated on Mark. I'll give him a ring and check on it. But I'm sure." "Perhaps this Dutch doctor made a mistake," offered Geordie. "It'd be a damn good doctor who could take out an appendix that wasn't there," I said acidly. "Doctors can't make mistakes like that." "Well, not unless he was covering up. Lots of doctors bury their mistakes." "You mean he was incompetent?" I thought about that, then shook my head decisively. "No, Geordie, that won't wash. He'd see the old operation scar the moment he made his examination, and he'd know the appendix had already been removed. He wouldn't stick his neck out by signing a certificate that could be so easily disproved. No one is as incompetent as that." "Aye. If he wanted to cover up, he'd put down the cause of death as fever or something like that. Something you couldn't prove one way or another. But we don't know what he'd put on the certificate. We'll soon find out. They sent it to Helen. And I want to find Kane more than ever. I want to nail that lying bastard." "We'll do our best," said Geordie. He didn't sound too hopeful. 2. I had no more dreams that night, but slept heavily and late. It was Geordie who woke me up by shaking my shoulder, and, incidentally, hurting my arm once again. I groaned and turned away, but he persisted until I opened my eyes. "You're wanted on the phone," he said. "It's the Institute." I put on my dressing gown and was still thick-headed with sleep when I lifted the receiver. It was young Sims. "Dr. Trevelyan, I've taken over your old office while you're away, and you've left something behind. I don't know if it's valuable or if you want it at all." I mumbled. "What is it?" "A manganese nodule." I was jolted, wide awake. "Where did you find it?" "I didn't. One of the cleaners found it under your desk and gave it to me. What should I do with it?" "Stick tight to it. I'll pick it up this morning. It's got some relation to work I'm engaged on. Thanks for calling." I turned to Geordie. "All is not lost," I said. "We've got a nodule. You dropped some on the floor of my office, remember? And you left one under the desk." "I don't see what all the fuss is about. All along you've been insisting that the damn things are worthless. So what's so exciting about this one?" I said, "There are too many mysteries connected with this particular lot to suit me. I'm going to take a closer look at this one." As I breakfasted on a cigarette and a cup of strong coffee, I rang Helen and asked her to read out Mark's death certificate. It was in French, of course, and she had some difficulties over the handwritten parts, but we got it sorted out. I put down the phone and said to Geordie, "Now, I want to talk to that doctor as well as Kane." I felt full of anger and frustration. "What was the cause of death?" "Peritonitis, following an appendectomy. And that's impossible. The doctor's name is Hans Schouten." It was signed in Tanakabu in the Tumutus. "He's a hell of a long way from here." "But Kane isn't." "Do your damnedest to find him, Geordie." Geordie sighed. "I'll do my best. But this is a bloody big city, and no one but you and Helen can identify him for sure." I dressed and drove down to the Institute, retrieved the nodule from Sims, and then went down to the laboratories. I was going to analyse this lump of rock, down to the last trace elements. First, I photographed it in colour from several angles, and took a casting of it in latex. That took care